Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Welcome to Reimagining Liberty, a show about the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical liberalism. I'm Aaron Ross Powell. The political right, including more right-wing sorts of self-identified libertarians, are rather down on feminism. For those right-wingers, their hostility is understandable, because feminist insights challenge truths the right imagines to be natural and immutable about equality, gender, and hierarchy. But for radical liberals, feminist theory offers powerful tools for understanding and critiquing power and its use by the state. Today I have on my friend Kelly V for a discussion of these ideas and their place within a radical liberal framework. Kelly is an individualist anarchist feminist and a graduate of Tulane University with degrees in accounting and finance, which she puts to good use when she's not writing about mental health, feminism, and the state. Before we turn to our discussion, however, I want to mention that if you value the conversations you hear on Reimagining Liberty and want to support the show, you can on my Patreon. Joining for free will get you all my latest essays and episodes delivered straight to your inbox. But you can also sign up to get early access to new Reimagining Liberty episodes, listen ad-free, and join the community Discord. To learn more, check out my Patreon at patreon.com/AaronRossPowell or look for the link in the show notes. Now, let's turn to my conversation with Kelly, starting with nailing down just what we mean by oppression.
So, first of all, oppression is a structural phenomenon that positions groups in relations of subordination and privilege. This is the framework put forth by Iris Young in her work, Five Faces of Oppression. And it consists of five different components. There's exploitation, which we commonly think of as wage labor, but there's other ways of breaking that down, basically being exploited for the product of your work by someone else. Marginalization, which is people, and marginals are people that the system of labor cannot or will not use. Right? Powerlessness is the inability of oppressed people to make decisions about their own lives. Cultural imperialism is the universalization of a dominant group's experience and their culture and its establishment as the norm. And then the fifth face of oppression is a little more obvious, which is violence. Right. So if you take that more comprehensive definition of oppression, you can understand feminism and libertarianism in very similar ways, which is feminism is the opposition to oppression based on gender and sex, reinforced by patriarchy. And libertarianism is opposition to oppression by the state. Right? And so if you view oppression as this more comprehensive framework that presents itself in various forms and through various means, you understand the ways in which these two concepts are interrelated. And so when I talk about libertarian feminism, I'm talking about an ideology and a framework that combines both of those things, right? We can acknowledge the role of patriarchy in perpetuating oppression, and we can acknowledge the role of the state in perpetuating oppression, and also understand that by dismantling one, you have to also dismantle the other.
As you were setting those out, though, this seems to be the disconnect that, so I'm putting on my kind of right libertarian hat right now, or the arguments against feminism or incorporating feminism into libertarian thinking that I hear from more right-wing libertarians. And one thing that jumped out in that is libertarianism, at least in its, in some forms, is hyper-focused on coercive violence. That's what its worry is. And the state is the is the institution that believes it has a monopoly on the use of coercive violence within a geographic area is one of the standard definitions. And so libertarianism says that's wrong. The state should not use coercive violence or should minimize it to some degree, greater or lesser, depending on the sort of libertarian you are. And that's it. And anything else that people do that is not the product of being coerced by violence or threats of violence is like not our concern. But the other kinds of impression you mentioned are not simply violence. They are structural, cultural, interpersonal, and so on. And so if we're going to tear them down or level them out, is there a tension there? Like what is the – because we can get rid of one of the five, like the kind of right libertarians, the minarchists, the anarcho-capitalists say like, well, yes, we agree. Get rid of the violence. But then when you say, well, we've got these other four. What do we do about them? And what does libertarian feminism say about like how we go about that if we can't use the state to do it?
Yeah. So first of all, I'd argue it's not possible to get rid of one without getting rid of the other. I think sometimes libertarians make the mistake of viewing the state as this thing that exists in isolation, independent of cultural factors. And our willingness to accept oppression in other forms like supports the culture that creates statism. And that's somewhere where I think feminist theory can be really useful for furthering libertarian theory, is understanding what are the cultural conditions in which people do not normalize power and do not normalize violence, right? And there are plenty of instances of violence being normalized by the patriarchy, even when they're happening at home, things like domestic violence or marital rape or things like that, right? And feminism recognizes that just because those are not legal per se, they are still subject to a sort of privilege and a sort of normalization. Right. And so I think to dismantle oppression by the state, the state also participates in all of these, right? It doesn't just participate in violence. So that's the other piece, is that, you know, I think if you're just critiquing the state on the basis of violence and ignoring everything else, you're not really grasping how the state works and how it operates. Right? Violence is certainly the enforcement mechanism for the state, but it's not the reason that it exists. The reason that it exists is because we have a universalized dominant culture that supports the state and treats it as normal, and treats state actors as privileged above other people. That's the kind of cultural imperialism element that I mentioned earlier, powerlessness, the way that people don't have the ability to make decisions that they could make without the state's interference, marginalization through systems like imprisoning people where people are mentally ill, immigration constraints, things that isolate people from the workforce, and then exploitation. I mean, taxation is the most obvious version, but there's lots of ways that the state perpetualizes exploitation as well, through, you know, making it difficult for people to make a living independently. So in terms of breaking that down or fighting against it from a libertarian feminist perspective, I think a libertarian feminist would recognize that both in terms of fighting the patriarchy, using state means is not going to be the most effective way to do that, because the state is an oppressive institution and it's going to use the same tools that the patriarchy employs and can easily be co-opted to that end. But then also recognizes that you can't get rid of the state without addressing these cultural factors that make it possible.
This is, I think, I want to highlight, emphasize what you just, everything you just said for listeners, because I think this is one of like the core themes that I try to run with on this show a fair amount, which is how much culture matters in when we are trying to make the world freer and more prosperous and better and more humane. That's not just a matter of mapping out economic incentives or looking at the structure of institutions or the formal rules governing them, but it's about the culture that either enables those things, enables oppression or whatever else it is that we want to undo, or the culture that excuses it when it's happening, which is something we've talked about in the last couple episodes of this show, is the one of the ways that some libertarians can go wrong is they can have this real focus on those kind of formal rules and incentives and inputs and outputs and so on, but then be willing to just explain away or overlook when there are people who are suffering in that system because they're being deprived of liberty or not having access to its fruits and so on. And a lot of that is bound up in a kind of unwillingness to engage at the cultural level and to understand the way that culture shapes our values and our virtues and our perspectives and what we notice and what we consider to be morally salient and so on. And so I think even if we, what I liked about what you said is we, even if we zoom out, we like feminism is a way to talk about that, but the broader point applies in all sorts of areas. We can talk about racism in these contexts. We can talk about nationalism in these contexts, that a freer world depends upon a culture that is conducive to a freer world. And so you have to engage at that level. And one of the things that I was thinking about, and you can speak to kind of this distinction, is this attitude of you can have feminism plus kind of these attitudes of oppression internal to it. And so when you were talking, I was thinking like there's carceral feminism.
Yeah.
Which seems to respond to like every kind of, the answer to everything is like lock them up.
Mm-hmm.
Is basically what you're saying that like carceral feminism in a sense is working at cross purposes with itself, that it's like self-defeating.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you can see that in what's happening right now, which we can get into more maybe a little bit later. But yeah, I mean, prisons perpetuate rape culture. There's something inherently in conflict with feminism to support putting people in cages, right? Like using the state is a very patriarchal institution, right? It doesn't exist in a vacuum, and trying to use it to defend yourself is to perpetuate feminist causes is only going to at best be temporary patches, and at worst is going to aggravate things and make them worse. Right. I think where feminists can use the state is to try to limit its own, like to limit the state's power, not to limit individual people using more state power. I like this quote from Andrea Dworkin, who's a radical feminist from like mostly the 70s, like second wave, which said, "There is not a feminist alive who could possibly look to the male legal system for real protection from the systemized sadism of men. Women fight to reform male law in the areas of rape and battery, for instance, because something is better than nothing. In general, we fight to force the law to recognize us as the victims of the crimes committed against us, but the results have been paltry and pathetic." And I think that's still true. Abortion protections have been rolled back in the last few years. We're seeing potentially other legal protections, employment protections for women rolled back. It's not the right solution to the problem. And then on the flip side, I wanted to talk about what you mentioned with libertarianism and the importance of culture as well, because I think early libertarianism, I'm talking like 19th century individualist anarchists, were very feminist. Like this idea that libertarianism is in opposition to feminism is a relatively new idea. People like Benjamin Tucker or Voltairine de Cleyre, the kind of proto-libertarians of that era were very much feminists, very much understood that patriarchy was oppressive. They wrote about marriage, critiquing the norms of the time. I mean, they're also writing in a context where marriage equates to like legal ownership of women by men. But this idea that libertarianism and feminism is in conflict, I think arises much more later in the 70s when you have second wave feminism overemphasizing things like being anti-porn or anti-sex work or things like that, where they're really pushing to criminalize activity that's between consenting people. But fundamentally, I think the early libertarians understood the way that oppression shows up in these different ways and that it was part of this comprehensive project. And if you don't view fighting oppression as a comprehensive project, I don't think you are ever going to achieve anything in that. And
can we talk a bit about what you mean by patriarchy? Because this is another point where I think people will object to feminist claims on the grounds that patriarchy seems to mean like men at the top, women at the bottom, or men having more power, women having less, or men doing better, women doing worse. And yet we look around and we see like, you know, the deaths of despair are heavily concentrated among men. Men are now in a decided minority among incoming college students. A lot of the unemployment was concentrated among, like, there's a lot of all of these indicators, and we talk about like the plight of young men, and all these indicators seem to say that men are doing quite poorly and poorly compared to women by all these measures that matter to us. And yet we have patriarchy, and these seem like something, what's going on there? Like men don't seem to necessarily be, some are, but like lots of them don't seem to be benefiting.
Yeah, I mean, I would define patriarchy, right, as a system of oppression, like we've been talking about, based on sex and gender. And that doesn't mean that all men are doing better than all women, or like you said, I mean, I personally think that the claims that men are doing so much worse than women are overstated. I think you're looking at pretty specific criteria by which that's the case, but you still have, you know, a vast majority of people in power are men, like just factually. But patriarchy can also harm men, right? It's a system that creates norms and essentializes gender roles and what the role of a man is in a society and what the role of a woman is in society. And those categorizations do not fit individual human beings. And I think we're in a really weird period in history right now where there's been a lot of progress, but we're seeing a reaction to that progress. And I think to understand where we are and how we got here, we have to understand that change is painful for everyone. And B, a lot of the things that men are going through right now are things that women have gone through for centuries, which is trying to figure out where do I fit in this world, or trying to push past, you know, the bounds of where they've been told to fit in the world. But even with all of that said, I mean, I think it's really important to view feminism as like a radical project, not just we're pushing for equality, but we're trying to understand like the roots of oppression and what does gender mean? What does sex mean? How do those things interact with our real life experience? How do they interact with other forms of oppression? How do they react with other aspects of our identity? And it's not going to be, like, it's never going to look as straightforward as men on top and women on bottom when you're in a position of change or transition.
Is this why we're seeing such a backlash right now around, say, trans identities? That if the patriarchy is to some extent kind of a system of essentialized roles that you have to play, and then a lot of the suffering that a lot of men are facing is that they are, you know, like, the economy has shifted in such a way that the jobs that bring you status and or that bring you success or that are accessible to you are not the ones that the culture has said are what you're supposed to do as a man. So right now, you know, like, if you want a high paying job right now, one of the best places you can go is the medical profession, nursing. There's always a need for more nurses, and nurses are paid very well. And it's a role that is accessible to a lot of people with some schooling. And yet men don't want to do that because nursing is women's work. Teaching is still overwhelmingly, you know, K-12 teachers, especially elementary school teachers, are women. It's just not the right, like, if you're a man who does that, something's gone wrong with your masculinity is still kind of baked into our culture to some degree. And so men are kind of unnecessarily making themselves suffer because they could be in these professions that are growing and thriving and so on. But with the trans stuff, it's a similar, like, these are people who are transgressing boundaries that you're not supposed to transgress. They are de-essentializing what was supposed to be essential features of identity baked into your genetics and the natural world. And so they're complicating what felt like fairly stable narratives, just like women entering the workforce caused backlashes because that was complicating a stable narrative, or men staying home with children. I just saw today a study that, unsurprisingly, fertility rates go up in when it's like normalized that men help with kids, which is not surprising, but it's like they, you know, here's the data to prove it. But that's destabilizing a fairly stable, what was a stable narrative, at least in certain circles, and is a narrative that lots of people, like trads, cling to or try to reinforce. How much of that is like bound up? Is this the kind of thing that feminist insights enable us to discuss or ask us to pay attention to that we might miss or have fewer tools to deal with if we are dismissive of the field?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, I agree. I think that is a big part of part of what we're seeing in terms of how people are treating trans people and passing legislation that targets them and things like that. I also think that with the progress that has been made socially and seemingly so quickly, right, in the grand scheme of human history, it's a lot easier to scapegoat and target a smaller group of people with less power than to scapegoat and target, you know, half of the population or even the LGB part of that group is a much bigger group, right? So I think there's some of that. It's like, you know, it's not popular for us to target gay people right now, so let's target trans people because most people haven't met someone who's trans, or many people don't know that they have, or, you know, it's a small group of people with very little political power. I think the relationship with feminism and trans identities is complicated. Historically has been complicated. And I think when feminists get into trans exclusionary radical feminism or turfiness, they are doing the exact same thing of essentializing gender that they're trying to oppose, right? I think the literature in feminism has evolved and gotten better, I would say, in more recent years, but you'll read radical feminists from like the 70s and the 90s, really that comes across as very gender essentialist and just totally off base, right? I think if you understand gender as this role or category that's been socially constructed and that we want to box people into, trans identities clearly transcend that and challenge that, and that makes people uncomfortable, and they do it in a way that goes beyond most people. And so, yeah, I do think that's a big part of that backlash. But I do also think that it's like almost getting their foot on the door and on oppressing even more people is like, let's start with this really, really small group of marginalized people with very little political power. And once we've won there and people have just accepted that, then we can broaden that category. Because the things that they say about trans people are now the same things that they were saying about gay people in the 90s. You know, they're grooming, they're going to take our kids, they're going to, you know, do away with marriage or gender or, you know, some the family, things that we hold dear and close to us and are losing. It's this small group of people is trying to do away with that.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Can you distinguish, just because it's brought up here, gender and sex, because a lot of this gets bound up in conflating those two. But the idea of gender as a role that you play and what that means for both, you know, the fluidity of it and critique of those roles.
Yeah, so it is complicated. And I would say neither exists in a binary. But I tend to think of sex as more biological characteristics. Those could be physical characteristics, chromosomal characteristics. They could be secondary characteristics. Right? That's hard to define clearly, as much as people want to try and define it clearly. Right? And then gender is the social role that we play, the collection of non-physical or non-biological characteristics that we associate with man, woman, etc. It's an identity as well. That's another area where definitions are complicated and changing. But I think the easiest way to distinguish between them is if sex is primarily physical and gender is not.
For libertarians or other people who, you know, their primary concern in the political sphere is state action or inaction, and minimizing the former and maximizing the latter, say. What insights from feminism are particularly valuable in that project? Or where do you see gaps? Like, areas that they miss, or they're failing to advance their libertarian ends because they're not taking seriously insights from feminism?
I think, like we touched on earlier, a lot of the cultural aspects of oppression or the aspects of oppression that are not purely based on violence. I would also say the feminist conception of consent is something that is very robust and also applies when you're looking at the state, right? Consent as this idea that it's not just literally someone forcing me at knife point to do something. Like, there are a lot of different contexts in which I may have significantly limited choices and therefore an inability to fully consent to something. Feminism has a more robust framework for understanding that. And when you look at the state, I think also applies to the way that people interact with the state, right? When I go to vote, am I consenting to be governed, for example? Or am I just dealing with the very limited choices that I have and doing my best to defend myself or, you know, make what little choice I have in an oppressive system that inherently violates my consent? You can't consent to the state. And I think that feminism framework for consent is useful to understanding the state better. I think they used to, like, 19th century anarchists used to use marriage and use patriarchy as an analogy for the state. Like, Moses Harman wrote that, "I recognize that the government of the United States is exclusive, jealous, partialistic, narrowly selfish, despotic, invasive, paternalistic, monopolistic, and cruel, logically and legitimately so, because the unit and basis of that government is the family, whose chief cornerstone is institutional marriage." And so you can use feminist frameworks to understand the social construction of power, the creation of hierarchy, the way that violence and other forms of oppression appear in individual relationships as well as in larger community relationships. The other thing that I think that libertarianism can take from feminism is, and in general, I think understanding oppression through a feminist lens, is that feminism looks at patriarchy, which is a form of oppression that exists in seemingly every time and place in human history, with maybe very few limited exceptions. And so if you can look at things through a feminist lens and understand the different ways that oppression presents itself in a bunch of different contexts, I think it gives you a lot more of a robust framework for dealing with it than focusing on something that's very time and place specific.
I'm always struck by the hostility that is directed at feminism among people in libertarian circles. Some of it, I mean, if feminism is, if your view of it is simply, these are people who want to use the state in order to accomplish X, Y, or Z. So your view is, say, the carceral feminists or others who have not heeded your important warning about the state is bound up in this same culture and is a version of the culture that is creating the oppression. And you can't really use that as then a tool to get your way out of the oppression. People who reject that, there is a kind of statist feminist set of theories. But by and large, it seems like, as you said, there are important insights here. There are important tools. There are important philosophical positions. There are important understandings and perspectives and values that ought to inform the project of pushing back on the dangerous powers of the state and the dangerous actions of the state. And at the same time, you have this, one of the questions back when I was at the Cato Institute, I'd get asked this by interns or other young people, when I was talking to them, is why are there so few women libertarians? There aren't. It's shifted over the years, but you know, it's kind of a dude's movement still in a lot of ways, especially kind of more right libertarianism. So where do you see, is the hostility simply assuming that feminism is necessarily pro-state intervention? Or is there something deeper going on there? Because it doesn't typically manifest as just, I think these ideas are wrong, because there's all of us think that lots of ideas are wrong, and we can say, I think they're wrong, and be fine with that. But there's this real kind of sneering contempt and hostility for this set of ideas that goes beyond, I just think these people are mistaken.
Yeah, I think a good analogy for this, like, this is not the first time or only time that feminism has been treated this way by a relatively radical fringe political movement. You see similar patterns in leftist politics in like the 60s and 70s. People like the Black Panthers or people like the DSA at that time, basically viewing concerns about feminism as secondary or a distraction from the real issue, whether the real issue is race or the real issue is class. Or the real issue is the state in the case of libertarianism. I think all of these want to view their fight as the most important fight and view other fights as a distraction from that, rather than viewing them as interrelated. So I think that's a big part of the problem in general, is viewing oppression as like a specific instance or specific type of thing that everything else comes out of. Like everything is based on race, and all the forms of oppression come back to that. Or everything is based on class. There's no war but the class war. And trying to break it out further into other things is going to obscure things. Or, you know, the state is what we should really be concerned about, promoting a more vulgar or thin libertarianism and not looking at these other issues as important, when in reality, oppression is a much broader concept and it requires a much more thorough understanding and approach to tackle. And I think there's the other side of that, which is that most people being men in a movement is a self-reinforcing problem. You would go to, even when libertarianism was kind of peaking 10 years ago, you go to a conference and the only panel on that conference that has women on it is a panel with three women talking about being a woman in libertarianism. Like, maybe, yeah, I'm happy to talk about libertarian feminism and I'm happy to talk about that, but there's also lots of other things that I care about. And so when you are going into a space as a woman with so few women, you immediately become tokenized. You immediately become that person who's going to talk about being a woman and why we don't have more women, rather than being valued for your individual ideas and your individual approach, right? And so I think that creates that self-reinforcing thing. I think there are also cultural issues with like people being creepy, like stuff like that. Like, that's not necessarily unique to libertarianism, but I think when you're dealing with a relatively small movement, that stuff is harder to, that stuff becomes more pronounced, because like a few bad people can make the experience bad versus in a larger political movement.
First, we'll get you back on to talk about all range of topics, Kelly, not just this one. But yeah, I think the point that you make about kind of competing domains of oppression is an extremely important one, and is powerful in understanding a lot of kind of intra-political fights and a lot of the culture of politics in general, which is this very like zero sum perspective on the importance of any given issue. Sometimes this shows up in silly ways. In like, if you're in a think tank, you'll notice that like each scholar thinks their policy area is the one that explains the world. Like everything is housing policy, or everything is healthcare policy, or everything is monetary policy, or everything is foreign policy, and it subsumes. Or when I was in college, there was a tendency professors will like, my discipline is what explains everything. Like the tools internal to literary criticism can answer every political question, or economics is all you need to understand the world, or philosophy lets you work through any argument. But in politics, it does seem like we say, if this thing really matters to me and this issue really matters to me, then if I acknowledge that your issue really matters too, it takes some of the attention off, or it risks people turning away from my issue in order to work on your issue. And I think what's really important about what you said, and a theme running, I mean, from your first answer about the nature of oppression and its relation between to feminism and to statism, is this is all bundled into this one thing. And really what we're working on is different avenues into fixing it. But all of those avenues are necessary, that we can take racism seriously while taking feminism seriously, well taking nationalism seriously, well taking state violence seriously. And it's not just about picking one versus the other, but it's instead that each one of them kind of advances the interests of the others too. If we can do something about racism, that undercuts the culture that reinforces patriarchic oppression, state violence, nationalism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, these other ideologies. And so I like that. I like that if we lose sight of that, then it's not just that we're kind of missing opportunities to find improvements elsewhere too, but that we're like undercutting our own mission by ignoring problems that are contributing to things being worse in like our own area of focus.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I thought it might be fun, too, to talk about some of the issues that I see with individualist feminism, because that's kind of the strain of libertarian feminism that you're most likely to encounter in libertarian circles already. But I think that could be interesting. So when I talk about individualist feminism, I'm talking about people like Joan Kennedy Taylor or Wendy McElroy or Christina Hoff Sommers, like those types of people, where like if you Google libertarian feminism, it will take you to the Wikipedia page on individualist feminism. So this is like what most people probably think of when they think of individualist feminism. But so much of the individualist feminist project of the last 40 years has been, let's distance ourselves from radical feminism and present ourselves as like the normal cool girl feminism, where, you know, we want to be in the workforce, but like we're just going to learn to appreciate men's sexist jokes because, you know, we're coming into the workforce and they're just being men. And we're not actually like, okay, well, why are they making those jokes? Like, why is it part of our culture that men make jokes like that? That was something I think Joan Kennedy Taylor wrote about, basically like the non-aggressive approach to dealing with sexual harassment in the workplace, stuff like that. But the more individualist you get with your feminism, and by that I mean the more abstracted from a institutional view of feminism, I think the more you lose in terms of, like, individualism is important. It's important to understand the way that all of us are individual people and there is no essential experience of being a woman or being a man. We all have different intersections of identity that make us who we are. We're all different from each other, right? But you follow that far enough and you get to a point where any choice that any woman makes is feminist because it's a woman making that choice. And that at that point, you have totally lost the plot on like what is feminism and what are we actually talking about when we talk about patriarchy. It's not just a women making choices, but it's also looking at the context in which those choices are made. And when you fall into choice feminism, you have no framework for analyzing what's happening like right now in politics. There are a lot of powerful women in the Trump administration, for example. You have obviously Melania Trump, you have Pam Bondi, you have Kristi Noem, you have Tulsi Gabbard. It's still only one third of cabinet positions, but there's a lot of them and they're everywhere and they're very public facing. And it's like, why are all of these women supporting fascism, supporting the rollback of gender rights, like equal rights for women? Why are they like the face of this super patriarchal administration? And there's this concept called the patriarchal bargain, which refers to the strategic trade-offs that women make within patriarchal societies to gain security, opportunities, autonomy, often by conforming to patriarchal norms and expectations at the cost of their dignity or their self-determination. And we're in a place right now where you have a lot of women making that patriarchal bargain. I will build myself up. If I can put myself in a position of power, the highest that's possible for me in this extremely patriarchal situation, even if that involves promoting the patriarchy and doing their bidding, at least it won't affect me individually as much. And I think people make those same kind of trade-offs with the state. They seek power through the state so that the state doesn't oppress them. And I think that's another area earlier we were talking about how feminism can kind of inform libertarianism and vice versa, is understanding the concept of bargaining, the concept of consent, the way our choices are limited under patriarchy or under the state, and the way that we further oppression by making those bargain-based choices to protect ourselves as individuals.
So then what's the path out of that? In this moment where, because you can, all of us can think about, like, we'd like to have a better world. We'd like to reduce oppression. But in a moment like this, it's awfully tempting to start make bargains. I need to take my own interests seriously, my own desires seriously, my own happiness or my own lack of oppression seriously. And so how do you make the argument that part of the feminist project is asking people, as we said, there are many men who don't benefit from patriarchy or are themselves oppressed by it in all sorts of ways. But there are plenty who do. And so how do you make this argument that taking these ideas seriously does mean that some people are going to have to give up some of the benefits that they get from being the ones up there oppressing or benefiting from these systems of oppression. And it's awfully nice to be at the top or to feel like you're protected because you've kind of given into this system.
Well, I would say, first of all, no one is protected under patriarchy or under the state. Just because you're not currently on the chopping block doesn't mean that setting it up is not going to come back for you. Perpetuating a system of oppression and perpetuating means of oppression is never guaranteed to go well for you. But also, this reminded me of the recent South Park episode where Mackie joins ICE because he needs to make his money, or get his nut, is how they say it. Don't get your nut at the cost of your soul. is the takeaway from the episode. And I think, like, yes, sometimes you will have to make sacrifices to make the world a better place, but the world will be a better place. And the kind of opportunities that open up for people when you have dismantled systems of oppression, I think, are hard for us to even wrap our heads around. But those opportunities will exist for people themselves, for their children, for people in their community, not just concentrated into the hands of a few with the knife dangling over your head waiting to drop.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Reimagining Liberty. If you'd like to listen to future episodes free of ads and sponsorships, you can become a supporter for just a few dollars a month. Head to www.aaronrosspowell.com to learn more.